This is People First Radio On Demand, podcasts, streaming, and MP3 downloads, available when you want to listen at chly.ca, iTunes, and at the People First Radio website.
CHLY 101.7 FM, Vancouver Island. On the web, www.chly.ca.
Grief is not a feeling. Grief is a skill. And the twin of grief as a skill of life is the skill of being able to praise or love life. Which means wherever you find one authentically done, the other is very close at hand. Grief and the praise of life, side by side.
With counseling and ceremony, Stephen Jenkinson has for a quarter century been guiding individuals, couples, families, and communities through the human sufferings, sorrows, and confusions in life. Stephen is a Harvard-educated theologian, a sculptor, and a traditional canoe builder. Stephen is also the subject of a National Film Board documentary called Grief Walker, a lyrical, poetic portrait of his work with dying people.
Whether sitting at the bedside of a dying woman or speaking to clinicians dedicated to delaying death, Stephen bears a message that most do not want to hear, that death is not something to be denied or avoided, but befriended. He has even sometimes been called the angel of death. Stephen's extraordinary claim is that death is the cradle of your love of life.
We're joined on the phone by Stephen Jenkinson for a conversation about life, death, and the Canadian culture.
Welcome to People First Radio, Stephen.
Greetings, folks. Thanks for calling.
I spent a lot of time at your website yesterday and today, and I'm going to share some of the things that you've written there as a way to open up conversation with you during this hour. And I'm wondering if I could just start by reading a couple of lines under your page, Making a Village.
Sure.
Years ago, I showed a film to a group of men who were newly bereaved about how Tibetans once, and maybe still, cared for their dying and their dead. When the film ended, the long silence was finally broken when one of the men said, "I feel like I come from nowhere." And I'm wondering if you could tell us about that dynamic and its influence in our lives.
Yeah, that situation was, I was showing a film about that was a CBC French co-production about how people care for their dead in Tibet. And what happened was when that film was over, it was obvious to everyone in that room that compared to the most basic way of life, which is extraordinarily impoverished in our terms materially, but that basic way of life in Tibet and obviously elsewhere included an absolutely clear understanding of what the living person's relationship to their dead are and what the obligations were that were also reciprocal. And these people were able to act and proceed and live accordingly. And that set everybody back on their heels because we all clearly knew in that room, and most people who are listening to us right now clearly know, that there's no similar wisdom and there's no similar practice available really to almost any of us that live in the dominant culture of North America. And that's the word I use to describe that is not inadequacy, it's poverty. And our poverty is really monumental in this regard. And where I see this show up most emphatically, of course, as you'd expect, is around the dying part of a person's life, and then subsequent to that, the whole funeral and the memorial services and the years afterwards. This poverty has really become very apparent and very tragic, really, for us all in that time period. So my work in the last decade in particular has been to try to focus our understanding of dying, our failure to understand dying and death, and to take it away from the psychological understanding, which is really the only one that most of us are willing to agree to, and instead try to draw our direction in a, to a cultural dynamic and a cultural understanding. And as I say, I probably presided at hundreds of deaths during the course of my clinical life, and easily 90%+ of them were bad deaths by almost any reasonable definition of the term. And yet not one of those people ever decided to die badly. Of course not. So how do we account for so many bad deaths in the most medically sophisticated culture on the planet? And the answer must be not that there's something wrong with us, but that we don't know otherwise. We have an instinct, perhaps, for something better, but no map for it. And I think the only way to understand that is to go to the cultural dynamic of why our dying is the way it is in our time and place. And only from that can we hope to have anything to do about it and to make a better day for the people who are coming behind us that we claim to love.
You've written that a new society such as our own, built by immigration without shared myth and history to bind us to a home place and to each other, makes citizens who envy and sometimes plunder the wisdom traditions of others in their midst, and real culture is learned and made, not stolen. This immigration, the culture built on immigration without shared myth and history, is this the prime reason for the poverty that you've described?
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of the things that we're taught in school constantly. I'm sure you were. I know I was that our forebears came to this continent because they were seeking religious freedom, because they were looking for a better day for them and theirs, and so forth and so on. When you start reading and learning, you realize this is they've got a good PR man, this story has, but it's not rooted in any kind of truth whatsoever. The truth of the matter is that the Europeans who came to this continent starting in, you know, early 1600s and to this day came here not because they were running to something. There was nothing here to run to. They were running from something. And whether it's the famine in Ireland, whether it's the closures of the common pastures in Scotland, whether it's the Industrial Revolution in England and therefore all of Northern Europe, whether it's the crushing poverty, I mean, just keep going and going, all of the internecine wars and treacheries that were part of Christendom in Europe and beyond, all of those were the things that people were running from. When you have a culture that's built on this kind of spontaneous mass flight, as North America was, one of the consequences, no matter whether you're talking about people from Scotland or Italy or Poland or Spain, is that they've all been obliged to leave their deep understanding of who they are behind them in exchange for becoming this kind of new non-entity called a North American. And that the subsequent poverty that arises from that is rooted in being ancestorless. Now, of course, in a DNA sense, that's not true. Everybody has ancestors. But in a lived cultural way, we are, most of us, absolutely ancestorless. No question about it. And this is the poverty that I was describing in the piece that you read there, yeah.
Stephen, you write that the historical experience here, the mingling of reluctant immigrant refugees and more reluctant Aboriginal peoples over hundreds of years, is largely unknown and ignored by the dominant culture, and our understanding of what it is to be human is not much shared at all. Tell us more about our historical experience here and this mingling of traditions.
Oh boy, this is vast, of course, but well, I guess the thing to be known is that if you're taught in school, that's the authorized version of your history. You're taught a kind of rather glorious vision of people seeking out this freedom. It's quite something. I mean, you couldn't even almost be proud of it until you start learning what your people did with their sought-after religious freedom when they got here. And almost universally, what you find is that they denied that very religious freedom to the Aboriginal people that they came across. That's very bizarre. I mean, you would not think that at first blush. If these people are seeking freedom, that their first instinct, once they'd achieved it, would be to deny that for others that they found here. That's not the first conclusion you come to, but that's exactly what happened. And it doesn't, I mean, it really makes your history look like a far different thing. That's the first. And then the second thing is the consequence of this migration that I've been teaching about is that people who look and talk like me in North America, you know, dominant culture, sort of Euro-Americans, if you want, we wake up every day in the absence of what we've lost, ancestrally, culturally, linguistically, and so on. And that's very much an orphan definition for sure. And you compare that to the way most Aboriginal people on this continent are obliged to wake up every day, which is they wake up every day in the presence of what they've lost. They can look around and see that it's still the same place, but they've no freedom to live in it as they once had. And so I'm not sure which of those two miseries is worse. I mean, there's plenty. And really, that's what's been mingled between Aboriginal culture and the dominant culture of the Americas these last particularly about 250 years. It's that kind of that toxic exchange of one deep misery for another in the name of, quote, trying to understand the other guy or perhaps trying to beat the other guy. And I mean, I guess it all came down to this where I was teaching not so long ago, and this woman came up to the end and she said, well, really, I think you're making too much of this because everybody knows that the, you know, the Aboriginal people are not really from here. They came across the land bridge and the Bering Strait and so on only after the last ice age, and they don't have much more of a claim to this place than we do. And I said, what do you think you achieve by pointing this out to us all? What's your reason for that? And she didn't know. And I said, well, I think what you're making a case for is that because this is true, nothing we do is indictable because nobody belongs here. And as an old Native person said one time about that very observation, he said, look, man, he said, just because you don't come from here doesn't mean nobody does.
This is People First Radio on CHOY, across the islands and streaming online at CHOY.ca.
The crucible of making human beings is death. Every culture worth a damn knows that. It's not success, it's not growth, it's not happiness, it's death. That's the cradle of your love of life, the fact that it ends.
Orphans are not people who have no parents. They are people who don't know their parents, who cannot go to them. Ours is a culture built upon the ruthless foundation of mass migration, but it is more so now a culture of people unable to say who their people are. In that way, we are relentlessly orphans. Those are the words of Stephen Jenkinson, who has been called Grief Walker at his website, orphanwisdom.com. Orphan Wisdom is a teaching house and a learning house for the skills of deep living and making human culture. We're speaking with Stephen Jenkinson about living deeply and dying well.
People are dying, and their pain is well managed, and their symptoms are definitely under control. And what is it you see in their eyes when they're dying? Well, I tell you what I see. I see a wretched anxiety and a completely overwhelming, almost toxic fearfulness. Ask them, what are you most afraid of happen? You know, 8 out of 10 is going to be what? I don't want it to hurt. And so we say, no problem. We can get you there. You can still be sort of present. That's the promise. And you know what? That's the hell.
Stephen, you write that as people begin to die, there is usually a great stirring of family and ancestral memory, not always welcome or familiar, and people begin trying to put their face in the direction of home. Tell us about that stirring of family and ancestral memory and how it emerges as death approaches.
Well, that's a good question. You got some good questions over there, boy. You did your research. This is going to sound very mysterious, and at the surface of it may not make a lot of sense at first blush, but consider this. Is it possible for us to have a memory of something that we have no lived experience of? I would say the answer is yes. I would say that in some minor ways we experience this with some frequency during the course of our lives, that we find ourselves in places that we've never been before that are oddly familiar in some fashion, or they feel friendly, or you may have other kinds of associations. But the point is, this whispers to us that, if I can put it very plainly, that the past is not over. When we learn about the tense of verbs in school, we think we're learning grammar here in this continent, but we're actually learning theology, really. And we're taught, for example, that the past is finished, the past is behind us. And we literally use that phrase, and of course the future is not yet. And we're one of the few cultural groups on the planet who actually believe that the past is over and gone. Most cultures, particularly of an indigenous kind, they proceed as if the present exists in some kind of barely divided symmetry with the past. What that means then, practically speaking, is that the people that are in your ancestral line, not your family now, not the people that you knew growing up, but going back behind 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 generations, that those people somehow, they have consequence in your life in the present, and vice versa. So when might you expect this to show itself more than any other time in your life? And this is what I've seen. That usually unbidden and oftentimes unwelcome, when people understand that in fact they are dying, not future tense, you know, not going to die, but this has already begun. One of the things that they find is they have preoccupations that they have no confidence in. They start thinking about things not only in their childhood, but even they start thinking deeply about their family and start missing people that they haven't thought about in years or at all. And ultimately, this comes down to the question of, what's to become of me after I die? And there's an old expression about that moment. It says, there's no such thing as an atheist in a foxhole, meaning that when the shit hits the fan, you find that you have certain convictions that may never broke the surface in your life before that moment. And one of them is that there must be something of me that persists. I can't fathom an alternative. And if that's true about you and I, then surely it must be true about all the people in our family line and our ancestral line that came before us. And if that's so, then our entire life has been lived in the presence of these people and their stories, and that our life story is in some way deeply informed by and in some subtle ways influenced by this presence. Well, if you've lived as if that's not true, which is the standard immigrant dilemma, that there is no ancestry that means anything, and then these things start coming towards you towards the end of your life, this is a formula for extraordinary chaos and great disturbance, you see. So one of my jobs has been for many, many years is to try to help people make sense of what their dying time is for, and that includes coming to an understanding of who your people are, and if there's such a thing as life after death, then who it is that might be awaiting you, knowing full well what you're going through because they've gone through it before you.
Stephen, you've said that our times are rife with death phobia, grief illiteracy. Kids are utterly on their own where death is concerned, and they come to it by dare, by drug, by an unformed fascination that disarms or terrifies parents and teachers. Tell us more about the way that young people within this cultural setting learn about death and about dying.
Well, I think a better way to ask it is, tell us more about how kids don't learn about death and dying, or how they learn really malignant lessons about it. I could give you, for instance, and it's not too far from where we are now, I was asked to teach in Nelson, British Columbia. And a girl put up her hand at the high school that I was at there and said to me, this wasn't a question, this was a statement. She said, I have a right to commit suicide, she said. And when she said that, the entire place just froze. And, of course, all the teachers and the principal and so on, they backed as far against the wall as they possibly could, because this is the best way to terrify adults there is for teenagers to start talking about suicide and dying and such. Well, kids are drawn to these questions, not out of some impossible-to-understand morbidity on their part, not even with fascination. What it is every kid, shortly after hitting puberty, across the planet, it seems, what begins to stir in them that runs alongside that puberty and that interest in the bodies of other people and so forth, is this kind of intuitive sense that all of this energy and this vitality and this hormone-driven excitement and so on, none of this is going to last, no matter how strong and persuasive it is now. And just because it's not all only your grandparents that die, because, of course, the longer you live, the more you realize it. A lot of people die in your age or younger than you. So kids, what happens in that time in their life is when they don't have an institutionalized, culturally supported initiation around that age of 13, 14, 12 or something, when they don't have it, and of course God knows our culture has no such thing, then what they do is set about kind of instinctively seeking it out on their own anyway. And what that ends up looking like is all kinds of gang-type behavior and allegiances, all kinds of really at-the-edge acts, you know, to see how far you can go without going too far, to find where the edge actually is between life and death. And, you know, all cultures understand this, and indigenous cultures have a way of giving form to this so that it becomes purposeful and not experimental. And, of course, in those cultures, that kind of experience is guided by elders. It's not guided by the kids' peers. But in our culture, the kids have no elders to speak of as a rule. They're surrounded by senior citizens, but not elders. And the consequence of that is they're trying to make their own initiation. But you can't have uninitiated people initiating themselves in each other. So what you have instead is the stuff we read about when somebody slipped over the edge, went a little too far, and so forth. It's one of the saddest things of all the sad things I've seen in my work over the years. That might be it, because when the kids come into their 20s, there's no sense that it could be otherwise, and they're left to invent a kind of, let's say, a spiritual understanding of themselves and their lives and their bodies and their lifespan. And as I like to point out, if you think dying is taught at school, consider this. Yes, they teach the lifespan at school, usually in the science class, but how come it's always about frogs? Frogs die in science class, but human beings don't. Well, we got a lot to learn still, eh?
People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and the issues related to health and wellness. Coming to you on CHOY 101.7 FM and streaming at CHOY.ca.
How we care for the dying people in our midst and how we die when it is our turn, these together are the proving ground, the cradle and the grave both, for every conviction we have about justice and mercy, about the meaning of life, about what love should look like and what it should do. Those are the words of Stephen Jenkinson, who's been called Grief Walker, at his website orphanwisdom.com. Orphan Wisdom is a teaching house and a learning house for the skills of deep living and making human culture. We're speaking with Stephen Jenkinson about living deeply and dying well.
You don't mind?
I don't mind it.
Being called the angel of death?
No, I don't mind it. I don't, you know, cultivate it too much, but...
And being willing to be the angel of death means being willing to do what?
Well, to be a faithful witness to how wretchedly difficult it is in our time and place to do something that is not, that is otherwise God-given. And I mean, we deserve better than we get.
Stephen, you say that the time is upon us after several decades of pain and symptom management to imagine anew what dying asks of us all and what a dying person deserves from us. What does a dying person deserve from us?
Yeah. I think fundamentally what they deserve from those of us who are not dying now is our ability and our willingness and our skill at being what I call a faithful witness to what it is to die in our time and place. That's first and foremost. In other words, instead of turning this into some kind of fantasy, wish fulfillment thing, that as long as we decide that it's that we're dying in the same time we are, I think it behooves us all to recognize that dying is one of the places where the great poverty of this culture comes into its full flower. And dying people are submitted to the most extraordinary medical interventions in the name of preventing them from dying. And then we call this life-affirming. And it's rarely challenged until you're well down that road. And I'm not blaming doctors when I say this, because doctors, A, didn't invent this situation, and B, they could never sell it to people who don't want to buy it. So the truth is there's plenty of blame to go around if families are very much complicit in this, and the dying people as well are very often. So that's the first job, is we have to be willing to know how difficult it is to die in our time and place. Secondly, what a good death is in my mind has nothing to do with how little or how much pain you have, although God knows when it's my turn, I don't want much, and I don't want it for anybody else either. But it turns out from what I've seen that having good pain management is not the same thing as having a good death, because more often than not, it means you're sedated. And I'm not talking about sedated death. I'm talking about a kind of a conscious death, one that the dying person undertakes instead of is a victim of. And so if we're able to proceed that way, what you end up with is realizing that a good death is really has such enormous repercussions all around the person who's dying that the best way to describe a good death would be to say that it's a village-making event when it's done well. That means we're not circling the wagons. We're not turning it into a private family thing. That, in fact, everybody gets a chance to learn about dying with every death that precedes their own. And that's sanity. And that's the way it should be. Unfortunately, we don't have that. And so one of our jobs, I think, is to try to make democratic the skills of dying, the skills of learning about dying, instead of making them the job description of an elite group of people known as the palliative care practitioners. And if we're able to do that, a lot of things will change in a hurry. I mean, it's already happening in the funeral industry, and it can happen in the kind of care that dying people receive as well. That's what I'm on about anyway.
Stephen, you've written, "It is a necessary and proper thing that all of us learn about dying and about death, about all of the before and the after, well before the time of being tested and told comes. We can learn before our gamble for more time is foreclosed upon by the passing of time. What is it that we need to learn, and how can we learn that?"
The first thing we need to learn, I'd say, is that dying is not a punishment for having been born, nor is it in the narrow sense of the understanding simply the inevitable consequence of having been born. Really, what dying is can be the time when the depth of your life, the depth of meaning of your life, what does it mean to have been born at all? Why were you born in this time, in the gender that you were, to the family that you were? Have you awakened to the idea that your birth is purposeful instead of random? And are you willing to proceed as if you're a person needed by the world instead of a needy person, the way the therapy culture proceeds? Some of those things can become very apparent to you in your dying time, provided that you're not running headlong as far as you can away from the news of your dying. I mean, your dying should never be news to you. But if it's not been part of your life, then what can it be but news, and of the most crushing kind? So I would say that our real job is to learn how to die by learning how to live deeply. And it doesn't require a terminal diagnosis to learn how to do that. But you do need good teachers who are willing to ask this of you. And in a death-phobic culture, I'm not sure that we have that many teachers that teach that living deeply can only really begin when you glimpse the ending of your days.
Stephen, we have just a couple of moments left in our discussion today. I'm wondering if there's anything else you'd like to add.
Oh, my God. We have packed an awful lot in. I mean, whoever's listening hasn't had much time to digest, I don't think.
Well, and maybe we'll have another conversation in a few months.
Well, we could certainly do that. I mean, I'm planning to be alive then, and if you are, then let's do that. But, I mean, I just probably close my end of it by saying that, you know, our great good fortune is that we've lived long enough to have a chance to learn these things. Anybody within earshot of what we're saying now has lived that long. And so there's no reason to be unnecessarily timid about them now. Dying well is a birthright, and we have to go claim it.
Thanks very much for taking the time to join us today, Stephen. It's much appreciated.
I'm appreciated that you guys were interested enough to have this on. It's great.
Stephen Jenkinson is a spiritual activist, teacher, author, and ceremonialist. He's also a sculptor and traditional canoe builder. Stephen has a master's degree in theology from Harvard University and a master's degree in social work from the University of Toronto. He is working to revolutionize grief and dying in North America.
This is a People First Radio podcast. People First Radio is an initiative of Columbian Center Society in partnership with Radio Malaspina Society and produced at CHLY Community Radio in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed in this interview do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the partnering organizations. Visit us online. Just Google People First Radio to find our webpage.